you. Seeing the fear in my eyes, he crouched down next to me and drew air in through his nose. Perfect, he breathed. There was something about the way he said it that terrified me, and I shrank away from him. Don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you, he said, reaching out and stroking my cheek. That isn't why you're here. But let's get back to the story. So, while I was waiting to find someone all of my own, I cloaked myself in respectability. First, I looked for a perfect name and came up with Angel. I actually considered calling myself Gabriel Angel, but I thought it might be going a step too far. So I had a little think, did a little investigating, discovered that the good men in films are often called Jack, and, hey presto, Jack Angel was born. Then I found myself the perfect job. He shook his head in amusement. The irony of it never ceases to amaze me. Jack Angel, defender of battered women. But I also needed a perfect life. When a man gets to 40 with no sign of a wife in sight, people begin to ask questions. So you can imagine how I felt when I saw you and Millie together in the park. My perfect wife and my... Never! I spat. I will never be your perfect wife. If you think I'm going to stay married to you after what you've told me, have your children. He burst out laughing, cutting me off. Children? Do you know what the hardest thing I've ever done is? It wasn't killing my mother or seeing my father go off to prison. Both those things were easy, a pleasure, even. No. The hardest thing I've ever done is have sex with you. How could you not have guessed? How could you not have seen through my excuses? How could you not have realized when I did finally have sex with you that I found it an effort, disgusting, unnatural? That's why I disappeared last night. I knew you'd be expecting me to make love to you. After all, it was our wedding night, and the thought of having to go through with it just to keep up appearances was more than I could bear. So, you see, I am not expecting you to have my children. When people begin asking, we will tell them that we are experiencing problems, and after that, they will ask no more out of politeness. I need you to be my wife, but in name only. You are not my reward, Grace. Millie is. I stared at him. Millie? Yes, Millie. She fits all my requirements perfectly. In another 16 months, she'll be mine, and I'll finally be able to have what I've had to deny myself for so long. Nobody, only you, will ever miss her. Not that I intend to kill her. I made that mistake once before. I leapt to my feet. Do you honestly think I'll let you harm a hair on Millie's head? If I really wanted to, do you honestly think you'd be able to stop me? I ran towards the door. It's locked, he said, sounding bored. Help! I yelled, hammering on the door with my fist. Help! Do that one more time and you'll never see Millie again, he barked. Come back and sit down. Beside myself with fear, I carried on hammering on the door, screaming for help. I'm warning you, Grace. Remember what I told you about putting Millie in an asylum? Do you know how easily I can arrange that? He snapped his fingers together. This fast. I spun round to face him. My parents would never let that happen. Do you really see them rushing over from their cosy lives in New Zealand to rescue her and take her back to live with them? I There's no one, Grace. No one to save Millie. Not even you.
I'm her legal guardian, I cried.
So am I, and I have the paper to prove it.
I would never agree for her to be put away.
But what if you were also proved to be of unsound mind? As your husband, I would then be responsible for both you and Millie, and could do as I wished. He indicated the door. Be my guest. Carry on banging on the door and screaming for help. It lays the foundation for your madness.
You're the one who's mad, I hissed.
Obviously.
He stood up, walked over to the bedside table, yanked the phone from its socket, took a penknife from his pocket, and cut through the cord.
I'm going to give you a little time by yourself to mull over what I've said, and when I come back, we'll talk again. Come and sit on the bed.
No.
Don't be tiresome.
You're not keeping me locked up in here.
He walked over to where I was standing.
I don't want to have to hurt you, for the simple reason that I might not be able to stop. But I will if I have to.
He raised his arms, and thinking he was going to hurt me, I flinched.
And if you were to die, where would that leave Millie?
I felt his hands on my shoulders and went rigid with fear, expecting them to move to my neck. Instead, he manoeuvred me roughly to the bed and pushed me onto it. As relief washed over me that he hadn't strangled me, that I was still alive, the sound of the door opening spurred me from the bed. But before I could get there, he slipped through it and, as it closed behind him, I beat my fists against it, calling for him to let me out. Hearing his footsteps disappearing down the corridor, I yelled for help over and over again. But nobody came, and, distraught, I sank to the floor and wept. It took me a while to pull myself together. I got to my feet and went over to the sliding doors that led onto the balcony. But no matter how hard I tugged on them, I couldn't get them to open. Craning my neck, I looked out over the balcony, but all I could see was blue sky and the roofs of some buildings. Our room was on the sixth floor at the end of a long corridor, which meant there was no neighbouring room on one side. Going over to the other wall, I knocked on it hard several times, but when there was no corresponding knock back, I guessed that most people were out sightseeing because it was mid-afternoon. Needing to do something, I turned my attention to our cases on the bed and began to rummage through them, looking for anything that would help me get out of the room. But there was nothing. Both my tweezers and nail scissors had disappeared. I had no idea how Jack had managed to get them out of my wash bag without me seeing, but as it had been in the hold in my case, I could only presume he had removed them before we left England, probably at the hotel, while I'd been in the bathroom. Fresh tears sprang to my eyes at the thought that less than 24 hours earlier, I'd been looking forward to starting married life with no inkling of the horror ahead. Fighting down the panic that threatened to overwhelm me, I forced myself to think rationally about what I could do. Until I heard someone coming back to the room next door, there was little point trying to attract their attention by knocking on the wall. I thought about pushing a note under the door and out into the hall, in the hope that someone coming back to a room further down the corridor would see it and be curious enough to come and read it. But my pen had gone from my bag, as had my eye pencils and lipsticks. Jack had preempted my every move. I began to search the room frantically, looking for something, anything that could help. But there was nothing. Defeated, I sat down on the bed. If I hadn't been able to hear the sounds of doors opening and closing elsewhere in the hotel, I would have thought it deserted. Yet, comforting though these sounds were, the sense of disorientation I felt was frightening. I found it hard to believe that what was happening to me was real, and it crossed my mind that, well, maybe I was caught up in some warped television show where people were put into terrible situations while the world watched to see how they coped. For some reason, imagining that I was watching myself on screen and that millions of people were also watching me allowed me to take a step back and look at my options objectively. I knew that if I thought about the terrible story Jack had told me, I wouldn't be able to hang on to the relative calm I had managed to achieve. So instead, I lay down on the bed and channeled my thoughts towards what I would do when Jack came back, what I would say to him, how I would act. I could feel myself falling asleep, and although I tried to fight it, the next time I opened my eyes, it was already dark, and I realized I had slept for some time. The noise of the busy nightlife from the streets below told me it was the evening, and I got up from the bed and went over to the door. I don't know why. Maybe because I was still drowsy, but I found myself instinctively turning the handle. When I realized that it turned easily and that the door wasn't locked, I was so shocked it took me a while to react. As I stood there, trying to work it out, it dawned on me that I hadn't actually heard him lock the door. I had simply presumed that he had, so I hadn't tried to open it. Nor, I realized, had he said that he was going to lock me in. I had come to that conclusion all on my own. When I remembered how I had panicked, how I had hammered on the door and knocked on the wall, I felt both stupid and ashamed, imagining Jack laughing as he walked away. Tears of fury pricked my eyelids. Blinking them back angrily, I reminded myself that as he had my passport and purse, I was still, to all intents and purposes, a prisoner. But at least I could get out of the room. Opening the door quietly, terrified that I might find Jack standing outside, waiting to pounce, I forced myself to look out into the corridor. Finding it empty, I turned back into the room, found my shoes, retrieved my handbag from the floor, and left. As I ran towards the lift, the thought that I might find Jack standing there when the lift doors opened made me decide to take the stairs. I ran down them two at a time, hardly able to believe that I had wasted precious hours thinking I was locked in. When I got to the lobby and found it busy with people, the sense of relief was incredible. Taking a deep breath to steady myself, I walked quickly over to the reception desk, where Jack and I had checked in only hours before, glad that my nightmare was over.
"Good evening, can I help you?"
The young girl behind the desk smiled at me.
"Yes, please. I would like you to telephone the British Embassy," I said, forcing myself to speak calmly. "I need to get back to England, and I've lost my passport and money."
"Oh, I'm so sorry." The young woman looked contrite.
"Could I ask you for your room number, please?"
"I'm afraid I don't know it, but it's on the sixth floor. My name is Grace Angel, and I checked in earlier this afternoon with my husband."
"Room 601, she confirmed, checking her screen. "May I ask you where you lost your passport? Was it at the airport?"
"No, I had it here in the hotel." I gave a shaky laugh. "I haven't actually lost it. My husband has it, and my purse. He took them, and now I can't get back to England." I looked at her pleadingly.
"I really need you to help me."
"Where is your husband, Mrs. Angel?"
"I have no idea."
I wanted to tell her that he had locked me in the room, but I stopped myself just in time, reminding myself that I'd only thought he had. He left a couple of hours ago, taking my passport and money with him. "Look, could you phone the British Embassy for me, please?"
"If you would just hold on a moment while I speak to my manager."
Giving me an encouraging smile, she went over to speak to a man standing a little further away. As she explained my problem to him, he looked over at me, and I gave him a watery smile, aware for the first time of how unkempt I must look, wishing I had thought to change out of my crumpled travelling clothes. Nodding his head as he listened, he smiled reassuringly at me, and picking up the phone, began dialing.
"Perhaps you would like to sit down while we sort things out,"
the young woman suggested, coming back towards me.
"No, it's fine. Anyway, I'll probably need to speak to the embassy myself."
Realising that the man had hung up, I went over to him.
"What did they say?"
I asked. "It's all being sorted out, Mrs. Angel. Why don't you take a seat while you're waiting?"
"Is somebody coming from the embassy then?"
"If you would just like to take a seat, perhaps." "Grace?" Spinning round, I saw Jack hurrying towards me. "It's all right, Grace. I'm here." Fear coursed through me.
"Get away from me!"
I cried. I turned to the young woman who was looking at me in alarm.
"Help me, please. This man is dangerous."
"It's all right, Grace," Jack said soothingly. He gave the manager a rueful smile. "Thank you for letting me know she was here. Now, Grace," he continued as if he was speaking to a child, "why don't we go back to our room so that you can have a sleep? You'll feel much better once you've rested."
"I don't need to sleep. All I need is to get back to England."
Aware of people watching us curiously, I made an effort to lower my voice.
"Give me my passport, Jack, and my purse, and mobile."
I held out my hand.
"Now."
He groaned. "Why do you always have to do this?"
"I want my passport, Jack."
He shook his head. "I gave your passport back to you at the airport, as I always do, and you put it in your bag, as you always do."
"You know very well it isn't in there."
I put my bag on the counter and opened it.
"Look,"
I said to the woman, my voice trembling with emotion. I shook the contents out onto the counter.
"It isn't in there, and neither is my purse. He took them and..."
I stopped and stared as my passport and purse spilled from the bag, followed by my makeup bag, hairbrush, a packet of wet wipes, a bottle of pills I'd never seen before, and my mobile.
"You put them back!"
I cried accusingly to Jack.
"You came back while I was asleep and replaced them."
I turned to the manager.
"They weren't there before, I swear. He took them and then he went out, making me believe I was locked in the room."
The manager looked puzzled. "But you can open the door from the inside."
"Yes, but he made me think I'd been locked in."
Even as I said it, I could hear how hysterical I sounded. "I think I know what happened." Jack picked up the bottle of pills and shook it. "You forgot to take your medication, didn't you?"
"I'm not on medication. They're not mine. You must have put them there," I cried.
"That's enough, Grace." Jack's voice was firm. "You're being ridiculous." "Is there anything we can do to help?" the manager offered. "A glass of water, perhaps?"
"Yes, you can call the police. This man is a dangerous criminal."
There was a shocked silence.
"It's true,"
I added desperately, hearing people murmuring behind me.
"He killed his own mother. Call the police, please."
"This is exactly what I warned you about," sighed Jack, exchanging a look with the manager. "It's not the first time this has happened, unfortunately." He put his hand under my elbow. "Come on, Grace, let's go." I shrugged him off.
"Would you please just call the police?"
The young woman who I had spoken to first looked uneasily at me.
"Please,"
I begged.
"I'm telling the truth."
"Look, Grace." This time, Jack sounded exasperated. "If you really want to call the police, go ahead. But do you remember what happened last time? We couldn't leave the country until they had investigated your claims, and when they realised they were on a wild goose chase, they threatened to sue you for wasting police time. And that was in America. I don't think the police here will be quite so understanding." I stared at him.
"What last time?"
"I really do not advise you to involve the police," the manager said worriedly. "Unless, of course, there is good reason to."
"There is very good reason to. This man is dangerous." If Mrs. Angel really wants to leave, perhaps we could call a taxi to take her to the airport now that she has found her passport, the young woman suggested nervously. I looked at her in relief.
Yes, 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 please do that.
I began stuffing my things back into my bag.
Please call one immediately.
Are you really going to go through with this? Jack asked resignedly.
Definitely.
Then there's nothing more I can do. He turned to the manager. I really must apologise for all this fuss. Perhaps one of your staff would escort my wife up to our room so that she can collect her case.
Of course. Kiko, would you please take Mrs. Angel up to her room while I call for a taxi?
Thank you, I said gratefully as I followed Kiko to the lift, my legs trembling so much I had difficulty walking. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Mrs. Angel, she said politely. I know you probably think that I'm mad, but I can assure you I'm not, I went on, feeling I owed her some kind of explanation.
It's fine, Mrs. Angel. You don't have to explain.
She smiled, pressing the button for a lift.
You must call the police, I told her. Once I'm gone, you must call the police and tell them that my husband, Mr. Angel, is a dangerous criminal.
I'm sure our manager will sort everything out.
The lift arrived and I followed her into it, knowing that she didn't believe me for 1 minute that Jack was dangerous or a criminal. But it didn't matter, because as soon as I was in the taxi, I intended phoning the police myself. We arrived on the sixth floor, and I followed her down the corridor to our room. I took the key from my bag, opened the door, and stood back, suddenly apprehensive about going in. But I needn't have worried. Everything was just as I'd left it. I went over to my case and rummaged through it for some clean clothes.
I won't be a moment, I said, disappearing into the bathroom. I'm just going to change.
I undressed hurriedly, gave myself a quick wash and got dressed again. As I rolled my dirty clothes into a ball, I felt physically refreshed and mentally stronger. Not wanting to delay a moment longer, I opened the door. But before I could step out of the bathroom, a hand shot out and pushed me back inside while another clapped over my mouth, stifling the scream that tore through me.
Did you enjoy that little scenario I set up for you? Jack asked, his face inches from mine.
I did, immensely. And, even better, I've managed to kill two birds with one stone. First and foremost, you've just proved in front of dozens of people that you're unstable. The manager is, at this very moment, writing an account of your behaviour earlier on so there's a record of it. And, secondly, you have hopefully learnt that I will always be one step ahead of you. He paused a moment to let his words sink in. Now, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to take my hand off your mouth, and if you so much as whimper, I'll force-feed you enough pills to kill you and make your death look like the suicide of an unbalanced young woman. If that were to happen, as Millie's only surviving guardian, I would, of course, keep the promise we made her and bring her to live in our lovely new house. Except that you won't be there. And who would protect her? Have I made myself clear? I nodded mutely. Good. He removed his hand from my mouth and, dragging me out of the bathroom, threw me onto the bed. Now, I need you to listen and listen well. Each time you try to escape, whether by hammering on the door or speaking to someone, or trying to make a run for it, it is Millie who will pay. For example, because of your attempt to escape today, we won't be going to see her the weekend after we get back, as she is expecting us to do. If you do anything stupid again tomorrow, we won't be going the following week either, and so on.
We'll invent a particularly nasty stomach bug that you picked up here in Thailand to excuse our absence. A stomach bug that will go on for as many weeks as necessary. So, if you want to see Millie again, within a reasonable amount of time, I suggest you do exactly as I say. I began to shake uncontrollably, not only at the menace in his voice, but also because of the terrible realization that, in coming back to the room to fetch my case, I'd lost my chance to escape from him. I hadn't needed my case. I could easily have left without it. Yet when Jack had mentioned it, it had seemed perfectly reasonable to come up and fetch it. If he hadn't asked somebody to accompany me, I might have questioned his motives in making me come back to the room. And if I had realized sooner that the door wasn't locked, if I hadn't fallen asleep, he wouldn't have been able to replace my passport, mobile, and purse. You're wondering if the outcome would have been different if you'd acted differently, aren't you? He said, amused. Let me put you out of your misery. The answer is no. The outcome would have been exactly the same. Had you gone down to the lobby before I'd had the chance to replace your passport, purse, and phone, I would have simply put them in your case once you'd left the room. You'll have realized by now that I was watching you the whole time and suggested in front of everyone that you had simply mislaid them. Then I would have had the manager escort you back here to look for them. The thing is, I know you, Grace. I know how you will act, what you will say. I even know that before we leave Thailand, you'll try and escape again, which would be very foolish. But you'll learn in the end, because you'll have to.
Never,
I sobbed.
I'll never give in to you.
Well, we'll see about that. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get some sleep, and tomorrow morning we're going to go down to breakfast, and, as we pass the reception desk, you'll apologise for the fuss you caused this evening, and say that, of course, you don't want to go back to England. After breakfast, where you'll look lovingly into my eyes, I'll take some nice photographs of you outside the hotel so that we can show all our friends how happy you are here. Then, while I go out to take care of some business, you, my darling, will sunbathe on the balcony so that by the time we get back to England, you'll have a lovely tan. He began to unlace his shoes. After all that excitement, I suddenly feel quite tired.
I'm not sleeping in the same bed as you.
Then sleep on the floor. And don't bother trying to escape. It really isn't worth it. I dragged a cover from the bed and sat down on the floor, wrapping the cover around myself, numb with fear. Although instinct told me to escape as soon as any opportunity came, reason told me that it would be much easier to get away from him and to get him put away forever if I waited until we were back in England. If I tried again here in Thailand and failed, I hated to think what he might do to me. He thought he knew me. He thought he knew how I would act. He had predicted that I would try to escape again. The only thing I could do was wrong-foot him, make him think that I had given in, that I had given up. Much as I wanted to get away from him, my main priority had to be getting back to England, getting back to Millie. Present. As we drive to Millie's school on Sunday morning, I'm so stressed about why Mrs. Goodrich has asked to see us that it's a relief Jack didn't bring me breakfast before leaving. He didn't bring any food yesterday either, which means I've had nothing to eat since lunch in the restaurant on Friday. I don't know why he chose not to feed me, but it was probably because Esther helped me finish my dessert, which he would consider as cheating, knowing all too well that I wouldn't have been able to eat it after the reference he made to Millie's bedroom. In the sick world that Jack has created for me, there are many things I'm not allowed to do, and wasting food is one of them. My heart starts hammering as soon as we're ushered into Mrs. Goodrich's office, especially when Janice sits down with us, her face grave. We haven't seen Millie yet, so I presume that she doesn't know Jack and I are already here. But I needn't have worried. All they want to tell us is that because she's been having trouble sleeping, which makes her irritable during the day, the school doctor has prescribed something to calm her before bedtime. "Do you mean sleeping pills?" I ask. "Yes," Mrs. Goodrich says. "To be administered, with your permission, of course, as and when she needs them." "I don't have a problem with that, do you, darling?" Jack asks, turning to me. "If it's in Millie's interest." "No, not if the doctor thinks she needs them," I say slowly. "It's just that, well, I don't particularly want her to become dependent on drugs to help her sleep."
"He hasn't prescribed anything too strong, I hope?" Jack inquires.
"No, not at all. They can be bought over the counter." Mrs. Goodrich opens a folder on the desk in front of her, takes out a piece of paper and hands it to him.
"Thank you. I'll just make a note of the name, if you don't mind."
"I actually gave her one last night, because she seemed particularly disturbed," Janice says as he types the name of the pills into his phone. "I hope that was all right."
"Of course," I say reassuringly. "You already have my written permission to take any action you see fit in my absence."
"What we are wondering," Mrs. Goodrich goes on, "is if there is any reason why Millie should suddenly have trouble sleeping." She pauses delicately. "Did she seem anxious or unhappy when you visited last weekend, for example?" Jack shakes his head.
"She just seemed her usual self to me."
"To me too, although she was a little put out that we didn't go to the hotel for lunch," I say. "For some reason it's her favourite place, although Jack and I prefer the restaurant by the lake. But she soon rallied round." Mrs. Goodrich exchanges a glance with Janice. "We rather wondered if it's because she hasn't seen the house yet," she says.
"I doubt it," I say quickly. "I mean, she understands that we'd prefer her to see it once it's completely finished, rather than with half of it covered in dust sheets and ladders. Unless she mentioned something to you, darling?"
"Nothing at all," Jack confirms. "But if it's bothering her, I'm perfectly happy for her to come and see it as soon as her bedroom's finished. The only danger is that she'll probably fall in love with it and won't want to leave," he adds with a laugh.
I think it's probably the thought of leaving here that is weighing heavily on her mind," I suggest, ignoring the way my heart has suddenly plummeted. "After all, it has been her home for the last 7 years, and she's been very, very happy here."
"You're right, of course," Janice nods. "I should have thought of that. And she's particularly attached to you. Perhaps you could reassure her that you'll always keep in touch, that you'll continue to see her once she's left," I go on. "If you want to, that is."
"Of course I do.
Millie has become like a little sister to me."
"Well, if you can tell her that you'll come and see her regularly once she's moved in with us, I'm sure that will be enough to allay any fears she may have."
Jack smiles, understanding only too well what I've just done. "And if Millie says anything at all, no matter how insignificant it may seem, that gives you cause for concern, please let us know," he says. "All we want is for Millie to be happy."
"Well, may I say once again how fortunate Millie is to have you both," says Mrs. Goodrich.
"It is we who are fortunate," Jack corrects modestly. "In fact, with both Grace and Millie in my life, I count myself as the most fortunate man in the world." He gets to his feet. "Now, perhaps we can take Millie to lunch, although she'll probably be disappointed that we won't be going to the hotel. I've reserved a table at a new restaurant. It's meant to have the most wonderful food."
I don't bother getting my hopes up. If Jack is taking us somewhere new, it means he's already checked it out.
We go hotel today?
Millie asks hopefully when we go and fetch her. Actually, there's a new restaurant I'd like to take you to, Jack says.
I like hotel best,
she scowls. Another day. Come on, let's go. Millie's face is glum as we make our way to the car. The frustration of not being able to go to the hotel evident. I manage to give her hand a squeeze as we get into the car and, understanding that I'm telling her to be careful, she makes an effort to perk up a bit. During lunch, Jack asks Millie why she can't sleep at night, and she tells him that she can hear flies buzzing around in her head. He asks if the pill that Janice had given her the night before had helped, and she says that it did, that she slept very well.
Like baby.
So he tells her that we've given our permission for her to carry on taking them whenever she needs them. She asks if Molly has come back yet, and because my throat has suddenly tightened, as it always does when I think of Molly. It is Jack who tells her gently that it is unlikely she will, that she was probably found by a little girl who doesn't know that she's a runaway and loves her very much. He promises that as soon as she moves in with us, he'll take her to choose a puppy of her own, and when Millie's face lights up with happiness, the urge to grab a knife off the table and stick it deep into his heart is overwhelming. Sensing this, perhaps, Jack reaches out and covers my hand with his, making the waitress who has come to take away our plates smile at this display of affection between us. When we've finished our desserts, Millie says she needs to go to the toilet. Go on then, says Jack. Millie looks at me.
You come, Grace?
I stand up. Yes, I need to go too. We'll all go, says Jack. We follow him along to the toilets, which are exactly as I thought they'd be. A single one for women and a single one for men, the two doors side by side. The ladies is engaged, so we wait on either side of Jack for it to become vacant. A lady comes out, and Jack's hand grips my elbow tightly as a reminder that I'm not to tell her my husband is a psychopath. As Millie disappears into the cubicle, the lady turns and smiles at us, and I know that all she sees is a charming young couple standing so close to each other that they must be very much in love, which makes me realise, once again, how hopeless my situation is. I'm beginning to despair of anyone ever questioning the absolute perfectness of our lives, and whenever we are with friends, I marvel at their stupidity in believing that Jack and I never argue, that we agree about absolutely everything, that I, an intelligent 32-year-old woman with no children, could be content to sit at home all day and play house. I long for somebody to ask questions, to be suspicious. My thoughts turn immediately to Esther, and I wonder if I should be more careful what I wish for. If Jack becomes suspicious of her constant questioning, he may decide that I've encouraged her in some way, and my life will be even less worth living. Were it not for Millie, I would gladly exchange death for this new life that I lead. But were it not for Millie, I wouldn't be here. As Jack has already told me, it's Millie he wants, not me. Past. That morning in Thailand, the morning after the night I discovered I'd married a monster, I was in no hurry for Jack to wake up, because I knew that once he did, I was going to have to start playing the role of my life. I had spent most of the long night preparing myself mentally, accepting that if I was to get back to England quickly and safely, I was going to have to pretend to be a broken and frightened woman. I wasn't worried about pretending to be frightened, because I was. Pretending to be broken would be much harder, simply because it was in my nature to fight back. But, as Jack had predicted that I would try to escape again before we left Thailand, I was determined not to. It was important that he thought I'd already given up. Hearing him stir, I huddled further into my blanket and pretended to be asleep, hoping to gain a little more respite. I heard him get out of bed and walk over to where I was sitting slumped against the wall. I could feel him looking down at me. My skin started to crawl, and my heart was beating so fast I was sure he could smell my fear. After a moment or two, he moved away, but it was only when I heard the bathroom door opening and the sound of the shower running that I opened my eyes. "I knew you were pretending to be asleep," he said, making me cry out in alarm because he was standing right next to me. "Come on, get up. You've got a lot of apologising to do this morning, remember?" As I showered and dressed with him looking on, I took comfort from what he had said the previous evening, that he wasn't interested in me sexually. "Good," he said, nodding approvingly at the dress I'd chosen to wear. "Now, put a smile on your face."
"When we're downstairs," I muttered, playing for time.
"Now." His voice was firm. "I want you to look at me as if you love me."
Swallowing hard, I turned slowly towards him, thinking I wouldn't be able to do it. But when I saw the tenderness on his face as he looked back at me, I felt a bewildering sense of displacement, as if everything that had happened in the last 48 hours had been a dream. I couldn't hide the longing I felt, and when he smiled lovingly at me, I couldn't help but smile back.
"That's better," he said. "Make sure you keep it there during breakfast." Appalled at myself for having forgotten even for a minute what he was, my skin burnt with embarrassment. Noticing, he laughed. "Think of it this way, Grace. As you obviously still find me attractive, it'll be easier for you to play the loving wife."
Tears of shame pricked my eyes, and I turned away, hating that his physical appearance was so at odds with the evil inside him. If he was able to fool me, if he was able, even for a few seconds, to make me forget what I knew about him, how would I ever be able to convince people that he was a wolf in sheep's clothing? We took the lift down to the lobby, and as we passed the reception desk, Jack steered me towards the manager and stood with his arm around me while I apologised for my behaviour the previous evening, explaining that because of the time change, I had forgotten to take my medication at the prescribed time. I was aware of Kiko watching me silently from behind the counter, and I couldn't help hoping that something in her, some kind of female empathy perhaps, would recognise that my distress the night before had been genuine. Maybe she'd had misgivings when Jack had suddenly appeared in the room when I'd been changing in the bathroom and told her he would take it from there. As I finished my apology, I glanced at her, willing her to understand that I was playing a role and to call the embassy after all. But, as before, she wouldn't meet my eyes. The manager brushed aside my apologies and escorted us out to the terrace himself, giving us a table in the sunshine. Although I wasn't hungry, I made myself eat, aware that I needed to keep my strength up. And while we ate, Jack kept up a steady stream of conversation, telling me, for the benefit of the people sitting at nearby tables, all the things we would be doing that day. In reality, we did none of them. Once breakfast was over, Jack took me along the road to the 5-star hotel I had seen from the taxi the previous day and, after taking several photos of me standing in front of the entrance, where I used happy memories of Millie to put the smile that he demanded on my face, he walked me back to our hotel room. "I'd like to phone Millie," I said as he closed the door behind us. "Could I have my phone, please?" He shook his head regretfully.
"I'm afraid not."
"I promised Mum I would phone," I insisted, "and I want to know how Millie is."
"And I want your parents to think that you're having such a wonderful time with me on your honeymoon that all thoughts of Millie have gone right out of your head."
"Please, Jack." I hated the pleading tone in my voice, but I was desperate to know that Millie was all right, and surprisingly desperate to hear Mum's voice.
to know that the world I once knew still existed.
No.
I hate you, I said through gritted teeth.
Of course you do, he said. Now, I'm going out for a while, and you're going to wait here on the balcony so that you have a lovely tan to go home with. So make sure you have everything you need, because you won't be able to get back into the room once I've gone. It took me a moment to understand.
You're not seriously intending to lock me on the balcony?
That's right.
Why can't I stay in the room?
Because I can't lock you in.
I looked at him in dismay. What if I need to go to the toilet?
You won't be able to, so I suggest you go now.
But how long will you be gone?
2 or 3 hours. 4, maybe.
And just in case you're thinking of calling for help from the balcony, I advise you not to.
I'll be around, watching and listening. So don't do anything stupid, Grace. I'm warning you.
The way he said it made a chill run down my spine. Yet once he'd left, it was hard not to give in to the temptation to stand on the balcony and scream for help at the top of my voice. I tried to imagine what would happen if I did, and came to the conclusion that even if people did come running, Jack would too, armed with a convincing story about my mental state. And although someone might decide to look further into my claims that I was being held a prisoner and that Jack was a murderer, it could be weeks before anything could be proved. I could repeat the story he'd told me, and eventually the authorities might find a case of a father beating his wife to death which matched the version I had told them and track down Jack's father. But even if he said that it was his son who had committed the crime, it was doubtful he would be believed some 30 years after the event, and the chances were that he was already dead anyway. Also, I had no way of knowing if the story was true. It had sounded horribly plausible, but Jack could have made the whole thing up, just to frighten me. The balcony I was to spend the next few hours on gave onto a terrace at the back of the hotel, and, looking down, I could see people milling around the swimming pool, preparing for a swim or a spot of sunbathing. Realising that Jack could be anywhere down there watching me, and would be able to see me more easily than I could see him, I moved away from the edge of the balcony. The balcony itself was furnished with 2 wooden slatted chairs, the uncomfortable kind that left marks on the back of your legs if you sat on them for too long. There was also a small table, but no cushioned sunbed, which would have made my time there more comfortable. Luckily, I had thought to bring my towel with me, so I made a cushion of it and put it on one of the chairs. Jack had given me just enough time to gather together a bikini, suntan lotion, and sunglasses, but I hadn't thought to take one of the many books I had brought with me. Not that it mattered. I knew I wouldn't be able to concentrate, no matter how exciting the story was. After only a few minutes on the balcony, I suddenly felt like a caged lion, which made my desire to escape even stronger. And I was glad the room next door was empty, because the temptation to call over the balcony for help would have been too strong to resist. The next week was torture. Sometimes Jack took me down to breakfast in the morning. Sometimes he didn't. And it became obvious from the way that he was treated by the manager that he was a regular visitor to the hotel. If we did go down for breakfast, Jack would take me straight back to the room once we'd finished, and I would be locked on the balcony until he came back from wherever he'd been and let me into the room, so that I could use the toilet and eat whatever he'd brought for me for lunch. An hour or so later, he would force me back onto the balcony and disappear until the evening. Terrible though it was, there were a few things I was grateful for. There was always a part of the balcony where I could find shade, and, because I insisted, Jack gave me bottles of water, although I had to be careful how much I drank. He never left me for more than 4 hours at a time, but the time passed excruciatingly slowly. When everything, the loneliness, the boredom, the fear, the despair, got too much to bear, I closed my eyes and thought of Millie. Although I longed to get off the balcony, When Jack did decide to take me out, not because he felt sorry for me, but because he wanted to take photographs, they were such stressful occasions that I was often glad to get back to the hotel room. One evening, he took me to dinner in a wonderful restaurant where he took photo after photo of me at various stages of the meal. One afternoon, he booked a taxi and we crammed 4 days sightseeing into 4 hours, during which he took more photos of me as proof of the lovely time I was having. Another afternoon, he took me to what must have been one of the best hotels in Bangkok, where he miraculously had access to its private beach, and as I changed into bikini after bikini, so it would look as if the photos he took had been on different days, I wondered if it was there that Jack spent his days while I was stuck on the balcony. I hoped that the staff back at the hotel where I stayed might wonder why they rarely saw me around. But when Jack took me down to breakfast one morning, and they asked me solicitously if I was feeling better, I understood that he had told them I was confined to our room with a stomach bug. The worst thing about these small forays into normality was the hope they gave me, because in public, Jack reverted to the man I had fallen in love with. Sometimes, over the course of a meal, for example, as he played the attentive and loving husband, I forgot what he was. Maybe if he hadn't been such good company, it would have been easier to remember. But even when I did remember, it was so hard to equate the man who looked adoringly at me from the other side of the table with the man who held me prisoner, that I almost believed I'd imagined everything. The crashing back down to reality was doubly hard, for along with the disappointment, there was the shame of having succumbed to his charm, and I would look around wildly, searching for a way out, somewhere to run to, someone to tell. Seeing this, he would look at me in amusement and tell me to go ahead. "Run," he would say. "Go on. Go and tell that person over there, or perhaps that one over there, that I'm holding you prisoner, that I'm a monster, a murderer. But first, look around you. Look around this beautiful restaurant I've brought you to, and think. Think about the delicious food you're eating and the wonderful wine in your glass. Do you look as if you're a prisoner? Do I look as if I'm a monster? A murderer? I think not. But if you want to go ahead, I won't stop you. I'm in the mood for some fun." And I would swallow my tears and remind myself that once we were back in England, everything would be easier. At the beginning of the second week in Thailand, I hit such a low that it became hard to resist the temptation to try to escape. Not only was the thought of spending most of the remaining 6 days stuck on the balcony depressing, I had also begun to recognise the hopelessness of my situation. I was no longer sure that once we were back in England, it would be as easy as I thought to escape from Jack, not least because his reputation as a successful lawyer was bound to protect him. When I thought about alerting someone to who he really was, I began to feel that the British Embassy in Thailand might be a safer bet than the local police back home. There was something else, too. For the previous 3 days, once Jack had unlocked the balcony and let me back into the room for the evening, he had left the room again, telling me he'd be back shortly, and warning me that if I tried to escape, he would know about it immediately. Knowing that I could open the door and leave was excruciating, and it required all my willpower to ignore the instinct to flee. It was just as well. The first evening, he came back after 20 minutes. The second evening, after an hour. But the third evening, he hadn't come back until almost 11, and I realised he was gradually building up the amount of time he was leaving me by myself. The thought that he might actually stay out long enough for me to get to the British Embassy made me wonder if I should attempt it. I knew I couldn't count on the hotel management to help me, and that without help I wouldn't get very far, but the fact that the room next door had been occupied since the weekend made me wonder if I could ask my neighbours for help. I couldn't tell what nationality they were,
because the voices that came through the wall were muffled. But I guessed they were a young couple, simply because of the type of music they listened to. Although they weren't around a lot during the day, nobody would come to Thailand and spend their time in a hotel room unless they were a prisoner like me. When they were in their room sometimes, one or other of them would come out onto their balcony to smoke a cigarette. I guessed it was the man because the silhouette I could vaguely make out through the partition seemed to be male. And sometimes I would hear him call something to the woman in what I thought was either Spanish or Portuguese. They also seemed to spend most evenings in their room, so I guessed them to be honeymooners, content to stay in and make love. On those evenings, with the sound of soft music coming through the walls, my eyes would fill with tears as, once again, I was reminded of what could have been. When, on the fourth evening, Jack didn't come back until midnight, I knew I'd been right in my theory that he was gradually building up the amount of time he left me by myself, counting on the fact that I wouldn't try to run. I had no idea where he went on these evenings, but, as he was always in a good mood when he came back, I guessed he visited some kind of brothel. I had decided, during my long hours on the balcony, where I had nothing but my thoughts to keep me company, that because of what he had said about making love to me, he must be homosexual, and I concluded that he came to Thailand to indulge in what he didn't dare indulge in at home, for fear of being blackmailed. I knew there was something missing in my theory, because being found to be gay was hardly the end of the world, but I didn't yet know what. On the fifth night, when he didn't come back until 2 in the morning, I seriously began to weigh up my options. There were another 5 days until we were due to fly back to England, and as well as it seeming an interminably long time to wait, there was also the added fear that we wouldn't leave when we were meant to. That morning, increasingly upset that I still hadn't phoned Millie, I'd asked Jack if we could go and see her as soon as we got back. His reply, that he was enjoying our honeymoon so much he was thinking of extending it, had made silent tears of anguish fall from my eyes. I told myself that it was another of his games, that he was trying to destabilize me, but I'd felt so helpless I'd spent most of the day crying. By the time evening came, I was determined to get away from him. Maybe if I hadn't been sure that the couple next door were Spanish rather than Portuguese, I would have stayed where I was, but because I had picked up enough of the language during my travels to Argentina, I was confident I could make them understand that I was seriously in need of help. The fact that they were a couple, that there would be a woman I could talk to, also decided me. Anyway, I was certain they already knew I was in trouble, because that afternoon, when the man had come onto the balcony to smoke, he had called worriedly to the woman, telling her that he could hear someone crying. Scared that Jack might see them trying to look over the balcony from wherever he was watching from, I'd stifled my sobs and remained as still as